The numbers are improving, but there are still big discrepancies in Duval County Public School suspensions when it comes to race. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9 on the radio. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, a Times Union investigation. Why African-American kids are getting suspended so much more often than their peers, and why the NAACP is demanding something be done about it. Get on the line now with your thoughts, your questions, 549-2937. Then later, First Coast author Michael Wiley on his new crime thriller, Monument Road. Plus, today is Giving Tuesday, how you can support us here at WJCT and some other worthy causes around town. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, members of the Jacksonville NAACP are asking why the Duval County Public Schools are still disproportionately suspending Black students. A new investigation out this week by the Florida Times Union shows that while the numbers are improving, there is still a strong discrepancy in local classrooms, and it's based on race. It's alarming because school suspensions are a known contributor to what's called the school-to-prison pipeline. That's a long-term national trend where Black students are nearly twice as likely as white students to be expelled from school. And they're 2.3 times more likely to be disciplined involving law enforcement, including being arrested at school. Now, critics of the pipeline phenomenon say African-American students are being pushed out of school and pushed right into prison. Now, you may be thinking, well, maybe they're being suspended because they did something wrong. Well, Jackie Simmons is the district's executive director of discipline and student support, and he says he has found many instances in which the infraction consequences aren't equally enforced. Or in other words, where Black students are getting harsher punishments than other students for the exact same infraction. Florida Times Union reporter Denise Amos has been covering this story for some time. She has the new numbers out in today's paper, and she joins us now in studio. Denise, always good to see you. Good morning.
Thanks a lot. Hi.
And here's our question to callers. What are your reactions to news that in Duval County Public Schools, African-American kids are still being suspended far more often than white kids? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax. You can also let us know what you think about this on our Facebook page. And so last night, the NAACP met based on the data you reported in the newspaper and demanded some answers, basically.
It was the education committee of the NAACP. Many of those members are former Duval County teachers, principals, top administrators who have now retired, and they are keeping a close eye on these numbers. Frequently, the district officials meet with the NAACP and report on a variety of indicators. This school-to-prison pipeline issue has been equally important to the NAACP and to Duval leaders over the years.
Yes. And what's so, I think, upsetting about this for both the NAACP and the school district is it's not as though the school district hasn't been working on this. They have. They're very aware of the school-to-prison pipeline. They know that the more a child is suspended or expelled, the more likely they are to be dumped into this pipeline. They've been trying to address this, as you've been reporting, right?
One of the biggest, most promoted tools has been the growth and the detailed changes in the student code of conduct. It contains a matrix that basically should tell principals and deans how to punish or support a student who's misbehaving. And prior administrations have said this is going to make it more fair. Mm-hmm. The issue is has that happened in all circumstances.
It's 549-2937 to discuss the Times Union investigation into school suspensions. And so what does the data show, Denise? How much more often are African-American students being suspended than non-African-American students?
Well, the numbers that I honed in have to do with out-of-school suspension. That's the most strong type of suspensions. And African-American female students are suspended seven times the rate as white female students are suspended out of school. And African-American male students are suspended at almost five times the rate that white male students are suspended out of school. Now, African-American students make up about 44% of the student body. White students make up about, 35 to 39%. So it should be one would think if you're just looking at the numbers that it would be kind of closer to the proportion of their enrollment.
As you've reported over the years, and as other education reporters around the country have shown in their investigations, sometimes these suspensions are appropriate. Mm-hmm. Sometimes kids who are of color are suspended for very minor infractions that white kids don't receive the same punishment or as harsh a punishment for. This is something that the Duval County School District has recognized. They're trying to get principals and teachers to recognize what they call and what educators have come to recognize as implicit bias that we all hold as a culture. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The concept of implicit bias says that we Americans in general have reactions to other people based on often their appearance. And a lot of times we're not really conscious of the differences in our reactions based on the person we're reacting to. And in education, of course, there's been on a higher ed level, more research done than I've seen done for K to 12. But that implicit bias might say that a teacher is more likely to react more extremely to a bad attitude coming from a kid if that kid is an African American. What I'd like to see more of is more detail coming from the district to kind of quantify what Mr. Simmons said, which was in many cases. Mm-hmm. There were instances where black students were punished more severely than white students.
Can you give us any examples that you found in your reporting?
Well, it's very interesting. I don't have an empirical evidence, but just in terms of anecdotes, often I'm talking to parents who are saying, my son or my daughter was suspended out of school. They were in a fight. I never knew what happened to the other student. And a lot of the complaints that I get about harsh or overly strong punishment come from African-American parents.
The NAACP is also asking the district to take into account that often African-American kids, not always, but often, have trauma that right. They're bringing into class from their neighborhoods and homes, and that can translate into disruptive behavior in class.
Correct. And there's a lot of research that talks about how children react to trauma. And the younger they are, the more likely they are going to develop systems of behavior to help them survive the trauma that maybe that behavior won't be always appropriate in the school setting. In fact, some of the district officials and the NAACP leaders last night discussed how students need help learning how to switch from that survivalist behavior to behavior that's more appropriate to school. And the teachers and administrators need support and training to help them, educate them on these kinds of behaviors. And that's kind of a different attitude toward this misbehavior than someone who's just reacting and saying, I need to punish this kid.
The most common reasons for suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, skipping school, and being disruptive. Well, and you found African-American girls, by far, being suspended the most, more than the boys.
Well, what I found was over over a period of 3 years, the rate of African-American girl suspensions kept going up. Mm-hmm. With boys, it went up, then it went down. Hmm. And I think that's because the district was really paying attention to that. Then it crept back up in the past year.
All right, let's go to your calls for reporter Denise Amos. Her investigation is in today's paper. What do you think about this study looking at school suspensions? 549-2937. Joe is in St. Augustine. Hey, Joe. Good morning.
Hey, how are you guys doing this morning?
All right, thanks.
I'm doing well. How are you?
We're doing great.
You just sort of was hitting on what my question was, which was there probably a certain percentage where the implicit bias results in the children being suspended. But what is being done about the antecedents, you know, African-American children maybe coming from single homes or poor neighborhoods, lack of food, stress at home that's causing them to maybe misbehave sometimes compared to their white counterparts who maybe are having less stressful home lives, and is anything being done about that?
Thanks, Joe.
I know that the district is trying to increase some of the resources that they use to help struggling students and families. For example, I know that they are contracting with agencies to provide social workers, mental health counselors, and they also have a program, School Options Academy, where they're trying to do small groups of students and parents working with each other and a facilitator to improve communication skills, conflict resolution skills, those kinds of things.
And they have a parent academy. It just shows you the role that the school system has assumed in communities over the years, taking on all manner of responsibilities that it didn't used to hold.
Correct.
And it's a function of family stress, family breakdown. Strengthening families is a big piece of this, that it's not necessarily in the hard numbers.
Correct.
But that needs to be discussed, because so often kids are coming into school from all neighborhoods of town, and they don't always have the best family support, the best family structure. Let's go to Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. It's occurred to me from time to time as I call into this program, we very often talk about symptoms of problems, you know, the school suspension rate, et cetera, and everybody's throwing out all of these ideas about how to fix it. But what we really need to get to is, what is the actual problem? All of these things are symptoms of people having problems, whether they're stressed at home, et cetera. But what is the actual problem? And implicit bias is getting very close to what the real problem is. The real problem is racism in the general society, from my perspective. I just don't believe that you can say, well, this is the problem. If we fix that problem, then everything will be solved. We have to get back to what is the basic problem. This same scenario exists in the Department of Defense. It has for more than 40 years. I used to compile the statistics. At one point, I developed a recommendation for providing punishment to individuals, because I saw that the minorities were getting harsher punishments than the white people were. Even with that recommendation, when the punishment was being dispensed, the black people were still getting higher levels of punishment. It was because they were more assertive, and that the bias of the individual dispensing the punishment, he would get angry at someone being insolent, supposedly, and impose harsher punishments. We have to get back to the bias of the individual that is actually providing the punishment.
Thanks,
That's
Keith. All right. What about that? And you didn't really research that. You're looking at hard data in your study, but what about Keith's point?
Well, there is, as I pointed out before, there are different reactions that people have, often based on their culture. And it's not just race. Sometimes it is whether you're low income or have exposure to people who are low income or not. So in one of the NAACP members last night talked about a case in which a black teacher told a group of students, you know, that she's black and she can do calculus and what's wrong with you? I'm paraphrasing here. But this is a black teacher. She didn't realize that she basically had probably made her students feel dumb. This is not just a racial thing here. This is clearly that there are some cultural differences, some styles of communication that I think are kind of not jibing. And as a result, the separations in our society are showing up in our schools.
Janet is on the West Side. Hey, Janet, good morning to you.
Hi.
Hi.
Once again, I want to tell you that every time I get on this, get this radio station on and you're on, these are some of the best conversations going on in Jacksonville. So
thank you so much.
Everything. No, I mean it. I was a school teacher for years until about 20 years ago when I left teaching to go to work for the teachers union. And I wanted to first make the comment that this notion of parents and teachers and schools taking on more and more has been going on for a very long time. I know that we think about what used to be, but I think it's more in our white middle-class culture what used to be. Taking on this role has been a long time, 40, 50 years of teachers and schools having to take, I've got to turn my radio down, having to take this stuff on. But I did want to say that I started teaching with no notion of how much what a child comes to school with matters. And I think that what you're dealing with here about educating teachers to be much more careful and much more observant about why a child is misbehaving is crucial. I also think that the last thing you need to do to a child is get them out of school, the one place they need to be, just because they're misbehaving. We've got to find other ways.
Yeah, taking them out of school. We're getting a few other people calling, wanting to make that same point. Like, why suspend someone? Hang on a minute. Oh, sorry about that. Why suspend kids? How is that going to help them? How, if they're struggling in school, why is kicking them out of school? How is that going to help? Hasn't Duval increased in-school suspensions?
Duval has increased the use of in-school suspensions as an alternative to out-of-school suspensions. Duval also used to have, this county used to have the ATOS Center, which was basically out-of-school suspension centers. The hope there was that you had an adult who was trained to deal with troubled kids, working with these kids, maybe keeping them academically on track, but mainly helping them face kind of what the decisions they need to make are. Well, ATOS is no longer being funded and has been phased out. So that's why we might have more out-of-school suspensions than we would have. So that's one part of the problem.
I see. Mm-hmm. And Brian just tweeted me a study because, as you pointed out, Denise, African-American girls are being suspended at very high rates. A study published this summer by Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality found that when compared with their white peers, young black girls are viewed less as children and more like adults. Adults in the United States tend to view black girls as less innocent and more grown up than white girls. They perceive that black girls need less nurturing and protection than white girls, and that this influences how black girls are treated in the education and juvenile justice system. The lead author of the report says that black girls can be targeted for unfair treatment in schools that effectively erases their childhood, and this begins as early as age 5. And so these cultural biases, particularly targeted toward African American girls, it's showing up in your data.
Yeah.
So, you know, black girls being given out of school suspension at just much higher rates because teachers have this implicit bias that a white girl is somehow more innocent, more childlike, whatever.
I think part of that, and this is my opinion, it's not something I've reported much on, but part of that is we tend to see and understand people who look like ourselves who we assume grew up like we grew up. I'm an African-American woman. When I see a young girl, I assume, if she's an African-American girl, that some of the things she experienced, I experienced. I give her more of a benefit of a doubt because I can understand her better. I think that that's at play to a certain extent.
Victoria is in Arlington. Hi, Victoria. Good morning.
Well, thank you. Hi. Yeah, I was just going to comment and thank you for your wonderful insights. I'm an assistant professor of psychology, and I just want to mention this is a really complex issue. I was going to talk a little bit about the Hahn Foundation and Mind Up and some of the programs that are dealing with neurotoxicity, but more to the point of dealing with just the problem, some way to address or intervention. We have a wonderful program here at Everett Waters called Call Me Mister, and it's trying to get African-American males in the classroom. And I guess if I were going to formulate some kind of informal hypothesis, having nurturing black male teachers, particularly at the primary grades, kindergarten through third, could do a great deal to help and certainly to mitigate against some of these behavioral issues, particularly for young children, male children who do not have, and the girls as well, who don't have a nurturing male father figure at home. But there are a number of wonderful programs lined up. The Lynch Foundation also has one that integrates almost meditation-type experiences in the classroom where children first have to de-stress before they can learn. And they have circle time where kids share in the mornings what's gone on the day before, and they can talk about their feelings. And then they can be engaged in learning. And finally, one last thing, my late colleague, Jerry Fuellen, Professor Fuellen, did quite a bit of research in mind-brain education. And I think that's the key, pairing nurturing male role models of color, particularly with young children, we can still make an impact. And using these brain-based kinds of teaching techniques that will help children be better adjusted emotionally so they can learn. And then they're not going to be, they're far less likely to act out in ways that will trigger, you know, be disruptive or trigger if there is such a, you know, and there's some implicit bias in society, but they'd be more likely to be, you know, able to learn. And that was really.
Yeah. Thanks, Victoria. Thanks for that. Mark on the West Side. Hi, Mark.
Good show. Implicit in all this is that, you know, there's a bunch of mean old white racist teachers out there, and you know, they come to school after they remove their KKK garb, and they're school teachers. I did a lot of interning 10 years ago, and I'm finding that probably every school, a third to a half to even more, teachers and administrators are African American. So this problem is not a bunch of mean old white teachers, because black teachers and black administrators and black dean of girls and dean of boys have their fingers on this too. They approve as many suspensions as the white teachers. In fact, 10 years ago, I remember I replaced the teacher for about a month because she was disciplined, because she, one of the things she was doing was writing so many referrals, and her kids were entirely African American. So, you know, without a little reporting on what is the racial makeup of the teachers sending these kids for referrals, I think this kind of report is useless, because it makes it sound like, you know, there's a big monolithic white teacher majority out there that's doing this, and that's absolutely not true. As many black teachers are part of this problem, if you want to call it that, as white teachers. And
okay, Mark. Yeah, I hear your point, and thanks for that. I disagree with Mark, though, that this report is useless. I'm glad he raised these points, though, because certainly a fair number of the teachers issuing the suspensions are African American. But I want to talk about this for a minute, because the NAACP is asking the district to engage in a more robust training program looking at implicit bias. Now, Denise, as you know, as an education reporter, implicit bias affects us all. And that includes Caucasian citizens of this country. That includes citizens of color in this country. We are all affected by implicit cultural bias. And so it's inaccurate for people to assume that, you know, that this is something that only white teachers are doing, because these implicit biases are a systemic problem. They're not the fault of any one teacher. They are systemic. Can you explain that a little?
Sure. Well, for example, a lot of times teachers write referrals for behavior that, quote-unquote, disrupts the class. Now, that interpretation of what behavior disrupts the class is up to the teacher. And it would be interesting for me to know specifically what happens with those referrals and who is writing them. We don't know the racial makeup of the teachers writing the referrals. Then what happens afterward if a student has a number of referrals? Often it's the dean or assistant principal or principal who decides how the student will be punished. Okay, we often don't know the racial makeup of who that person is based on these numbers. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting for the district to maybe release more information about where, specifically, I'm looking at out-of-school suspensions, who is writing those suspensions, mm-hmm. the racial makeup of the person writing the referral and the person making the decision of on how the kids are punished. It is possible that you'll have the same rate from a black teacher or a black principal as you would a white teacher or a white principal. We don't know because we haven't seen those numbers. But the training, generally speaking, is culture and climate kind of training, cultural sensitivity training. That implies that basically we're going to take all of our educators, move them a little bit out of their cultural comfort zone, and sort of expose them to how other people are experiencing life, how their students are experiencing life. A lot of these educators are middle-class people, or better. They're not necessarily lower-income people. So they might actually need to kind of get some mm-hmm. exposure to different views of life. And often, think about how sometimes a student who's misbehaving is reacting. They're often reacting defensively or deciding, oh, no, I'm not going to do something that someone told me to do, or I'm going to put up a very strong, stoic front. That is something that that sociologists say that children adapt, that kind of attitude or that kind of response is something that they adapt because it works well to protect them in hostile situations, be it in their neighborhoods, be it in their family. This is how these students have learned to survive. And once again, how do you switch that so that they know that they feel safe and comfortable in school? That hopefully can be a result from more teachers, more educators getting culturally sensitive instruction and training.
It's a fascinating and important report in today's Florida Times Union. You can read it today. Reporter Denise Smith-Amos, always great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. Today is Giving Tuesday. How you can support this nonprofit WJCT, we'll tell you about that later. But up next, First Coast novelist Michael Wiley and his new thriller, Monument Road, back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Support WJCT this Giving Tuesday. Tell the world that you believe in public media and trust us to bring the best in news, arts, education, and inspiring programming to the First Coast. Visit wjct.org/giving. WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 15th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Two Men in a Truck, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to wjct.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville author Michael Wiley is building a national reputation for his riveting black-as-night crime novels set right here on the First Coast. Wiley's latest thriller, Monument Road, is out this Friday. It's about an exonerated death row inmate investigating the crime that unfairly sent him to prison. Michael Wiley, good morning.
Good morning.
Monument Road, I know where that is.
Right, right.
So you draw upon the First Coast for these amazing novels. And of course, you're a stranger in a strange land. I can really relate to this. You come from Chicago. I lived there for years, too. And not a day goes by that I don't look around this town and say to myself, I am not from here. And I know you feel the same way. And that's what makes such great stories, because you're looking at this area as an observer.
Yes. You know, when we first arrived, I thought this would be a great place to write about. At that point, I was writing about Chicago in some of my novels.
Yes.
And I knew that I needed a little time to get at least somewhat familiar, because it's easy not to see the details when one first arrives. Mm-hmm. But I've found that the textures of this place, the people, they're just wonderful to write about.
It's endlessly fascinating. Amazing characters and settings. And you've done such a beautiful job bringing it to life with your books. So tell me about the new one, Monument Road. It's about a man who's unfairly put on death row.
That's right. 8 years before the book begins, two teenage boys, young teenage boys, are found killed along Monument Road. And a young man named Frankie Dast is accused and then convicted of those killings. He spends 8 years in prison on death row for the first part of it before he is exonerated. When he comes out, he ends up working with a group named the Justice Now Initiative, and he investigates two things. He investigates the crime that sent him to prison, and also investigates the police officer who seemed really intent on sending him there. Along the way, he, you know, as he's out, because that's a pretty dark story, he falls in love. And in some ways, by the end of the story, he's beginning to find the way that he loves himself, too.
You've always been drawn to noir. And Kirkus Reviews has really praised your style of writing. They say, if you like your noir pitch black, you'll like Michael Wiley. That's pretty high praise.
I don't know why I'm drawn to the dark, but I really am. I'm a pretty bright, you know, person in terms of my temperament. You know, I'm a happy person. But I've always loved crime dramas. You know, from the time that I was very, very young, I loved reading mysteries and thrillers. And so that it's a place where I find a lot of pleasure, and I hope I give it too.
And in the past, when we've talked about your books, you've talked about Duval as being so unlike the rest of Florida. It's really neither fish nor fowl. It's sort of a twilight place. It's sort of an in-between place. And that makes for some interesting writing.
Right. You know, I love the mix. I love the conflicts. I love the contradictions. I love the tensions in a place that's, you know, in so many ways at the border between places. You know, we're the First Coast. And so one goes back very deep in history and finds those conflicts and those encounters. And then, of course, now we're just over the Georgia border, and sometimes my characters go into Georgia. They spend a lot of time downtown here and at the beaches. And I love those various spaces and the way that, you know, the interplay between them and the people in them.
Now, you have your book here, and you're going to read a little bit from Monument Road. Let's listen.
This scene, this is the very beginning of the book, and this is where Frankie Dast has not yet been accused. On the night that the Bronson boys died, I went fishing. At midnight, before the clouds moved in, a sliver moon hung over the Fulton Landing boat ramp like a hook that would snag the whole world and reel it in. I stood in the ocean at the bottom of the ramp, and I cast a finger mullet onto a sandbar in the deeper water. The bait settled until it touched sand. I felt it touch as if fingers neared my skin and the air between us had heat and friction. The story goes on from there, and Frankie Dast is a young man who loves to run in the woods, spend time in the water. Very quickly, he's shooting down a highway at 2 a.m, and he sees a car on the side of the road that seems to have had some kind of problem, and two young teenage boys, too young to drive it, who are standing there next to it, and he pulls over and tries to help them. His fingerprints are on the car. There's all kinds of other evidence that suggests he might have been involved with those children, and we roll from there.
Excellent. Why did you pick Monument Road?
Among other things, I love the resonance of the title, right? You know, Monument Road, the memories, the way that one can have a monument to something that has happened. And it's also a road that winds through so much of a certain part of this city's history.
Mm-hmm. It goes up to the Rebalt Monument.
That's right. It goes up to the monument there, but it also goes through some wetlands. It goes through some very abandoned area, and then eventually, coming out into the Regency area. And so I love that combination. It's a road that takes us through different parts of the town and transitions that way.
Well, you can come out and meet Michael as he gives a Monument Road talk and book signing. This is coming up not this week, but next Thursday, December 7th, 5:30 p.m. at Chamblin's Uptown Bookstore downtown on Laura Street. Should be an excellent, and by the way, a perfect holiday gift for someone's coffee table.
I couldn't have said that better myself. It'll be 5:30 to 7:30. I'll be at Chamblin's Uptown on Laura Street. Looking forward to seeing anybody who can come out on December 7th.
Come on out and meet Jacksonville's own author, Michael Wiley. His new one is Monument Road. Again, that's next Thursday, December 7th, 5:30 p.m. at Chamblin's. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Sold the ranch in Wyoming that had been home to my family for almost 100 years. This ranch had survived the Indian Wars and the Great Depression, but it could not survive the death of my grandfather.
Join us for stories from the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey, Car Talk fans, if you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend at the Jacksonville Symphony, enjoy the German Giants as the Florida Blue Masterworks Series presents Beethoven to Schoenberg with music director Courtney Lewis. Lewis just signed a 3-year contract extension that will retain him as artistic leader at the symphony through the 2020-2021 season. He joins us now in studio, and congratulations.
Thank you, Melissa. It's lovely to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's exciting to hear that you'll be with us for several more years. You've become such an important addition to the local scene, so good news.
Thank you. It's very exciting. You know, I feel like a Jacksonvillian now. I've lived here for a year and a half in Avondale, and there are so many wonderful things about being here. You know, aside from the symphony, the quality of life in Jacksonville, the excitement that there is about the art scene expanding. We were just sitting outside the guests today talking about all the things that we love about Jacksonville. And for me, when I come home here from somewhere else, it's always such a wonderful experience to be here in the wonderful weather and to be able to study and help the orchestra grow. It's a wonderful cultural community as well. And I'm very excited to be a part of that as the orchestra grows.
It's exciting to see the growth you've brought to the symphony. You've brought younger fans to the symphony, which was a big part of why they hired you, I know.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you think that that's the case, because our audiences are getting much more diverse. And it's exciting because, you know, orchestral music is something that I love passionately. This weekend, we're playing Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, probably my favorite piece of symphonic music, a piece that gives you all of life's experiences in an hour. And being able to share that with people of all ages and backgrounds in Jacksonville is so important. We're an orchestra for the whole community. And with our expanded programming, with our different kinds of concerts, it's wonderful to see the orchestra becoming a more integral part of the city.
Yeah. Now, as December kicks off, this is exciting. This weekend, you're doing Schoenberg, Mendelssohn, and Beethoven.
So this weekend, the Schoenberg Five Orchestral Pieces were written in the early 20th century. And if any of you know the paintings of Kandinsky or Egon Schiele, these paintings that express a kind of existential angst or crisis that was happening at the beginning of the century. Or if any of you know Tom and Jerry cartoons, that kind of crazy music. Uh-huh. This is what the Schoenberg sounds like. And then we have Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, which really changed the world. Our whole concept of a romantic artist, you know, of a figure who sees visionary things and who expresses himself in music, that's all from Beethoven. And this was the first piece in which he was able to do it. So it's a really exciting weekend. And I'm looking forward very much to sharing these pieces with everybody. So please come and hear us.
That's right.
You know, we have an orchestra here that is a leader. Every major city in America has a great symphony orchestra, and we have a great one in Jacksonville. Our orchestra is the biggest budget cultural thing that we have in the city, and I think a lot of people know about the orchestra and appreciate that it's a great thing, but for some reason don't come and hear us. So I would just invite everybody to challenge yourself. Come and hear us this weekend or another time, and I guarantee that you'll be surprised and that you'll have a wonderful time and that you'll be back.
It really is a cultural gem. And as you said, no city can call itself a world-class city without a symphony orchestra.
That's right. That's right.
And not only that, you are in demand as a conductor, music director around the world. So Jacksonville is actually lucky to have you for how many months of the year is it now? Are you with us?
Well, I live here, so
you
I'm always here.
You really live here now.
Yeah, I mean, the first 2 years that I did the job, I was still living in New York, which was very difficult. And, you know, part of the thing that we've been doing with the orchestra is really expanding our mission. And for me to do that, I wanted to be really here. And living in Jacksonville, as I said, has been something wonderful. Yeah, I conduct all over the place, all over the States and in Europe and in Asia. But it's very, very exciting as a conductor to be able to lead an institution and to shape the way the orchestra plays yourself. And, you know, I don't think it's boasting too much to say that the way the orchestra plays has improved and got so much more visceral and exciting over the last few years. So to be able to lead that change has been really rewarding.
Get your tickets now for the Symphony, the German Giants, this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then the following weekend, a beloved tradition, the Holiday Pops Concerts, December 7th through 10th. That's going to be an amazing opportunity. Get your tickets early for that because those go quickly. Courtney Lewis, always great to see you. Glad you're staying in town for many years to come. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Get your tickets now, jackssymphony.org, and we'll be right back.
The tobacco industry is speaking the truth about cigarettes. 11 years after a federal court forced it to.
Smoking kills, on average, 1,200 Americans every day.
These so-called corrective ads will run for a year and should be hard to miss. Big Tobacco's Big Apology, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, who specializes in pediatric anesthesiology and has written a memoir. And we hear from Jesmyn Ward, who just won a National Book Award for her novel Sing, Unburied Sing, about a boy with a black mother and white father growing up in contemporary rural Mississippi. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Al Franken apologizes, John Conyers gives up a committee post, but neither resigns. What does their party say?
We are strengthened by due process. Just because someone is accused, was it one accusation, is it two?
Democrats confront moral clarity, hypocrisy, and political reality. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The WJCT app. Now you can watch PBS programs on demand, including PBS Kids, right from your phone or tablet. Listen to live streaming audio, WJCT News, and NPR programs.
This is First Coast Connect.
Easily access the WJCT TV and radio schedule. Connect to WJCT social media and much more. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, today is Giving Tuesday. It refers to the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, and it's become a movement around the world to create a day of giving at the start of the holiday season. Giving Tuesday began in 2012 at the 92nd Street Y and the United Nations Foundation in New York as a response to the commercialization in the post-Thanksgiving season, the frenzy of buying on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. People typically like to support a nonprofit on Giving Tuesday. We here at WJCT hope you will take a moment to support us. Yes, us. We are a nonprofit organization, too. If you go to our website, wjct.org, just click the button you'll see right on our homepage and donate whatever amount fits your budget to support your favorite public radio station. If you listen to us all the time, well, you know, support us. It's Giving Tuesday. We really hope you do that today. Again, just go to wjct.org. And there's another worthy local nonprofit we are also spotlighting on this Giving Tuesday. It's Jacksonville's own Rethreaded. Founder Kristen Keene joins us now in studio with a huge announcement. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you have big news.
We have the biggest news so far probably in the history of Rethreaded, yes.
Yes. Now, Rethreaded, of course, is the nonprofit you founded to help women leave the vicious cycle of sex trafficking. And your tagline is sewing a new story. They take old materials like old T-shirts, old textiles, and they repurpose them into beautiful new creations that you then sell. And it's just an amazing concept. And it's been so successful. So successful, in fact, that you've attracted the sponsorship of a huge company.
I know.
Can you tell us?
Yes.
Drum roll, please.
We are now partners with Southwest Airlines.
Southwest Airlines!
Yay!
Yay! Oh, my gosh.
I haven't been able to talk about it, like, out in the open. So this is so exciting.
How did this come about?
This happened through like a connection of a connection of a connection. Southwest Airlines was starting an upcycling program, and through a connection of a connection, they found out about us. Yeah.
So what does this partnership involve?
Well, Southwest Airlines started an upcycling program, so they redid all their seats and their planes. So instead of putting the leather into landfills, they decided to donate it to different organizations around the world. That could transform it and affect and change lives. So it's basically Southwest being an amazing company and doing good. So now they we have this partnership with them. They're doing the national launch here tonight at Rethreaded. They've made us a promo video that they're putting all over their social media. And they're flying in executives tonight, and they're going to sell our product on their website. We're selling our product, our Southwest Airlines product on our website. I mean, it's just... It is so exciting.
Wow. So Southwest Airlines is donating some of their old textiles
yes.
to you, Rethreaded.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All their leather.
All their old leather from their seats, yes. from their airline seats?
27 pallets of leather.
Wow. And yeah. What are you going to make out of it?
Well, this is the debut. We have some necklaces, some earrings.
You're wearing one. It's
yes,
beautiful.
I'm wearing one. I know. I love it. It's super simple, classic. We have some key fobs, some key rings.
Amazing holiday yes. gifts.
Amazing holiday gifts. Yes.
This is so exciting, and I just am thrilled for you.
Thank you.
Because what you have done with Rethreaded is the absolute worst of humanity, the most hideous impulses, the worst of human beings. What you have done is inverted that and created something beautiful. And you have pulled women out of the worst possible situations imaginable and found a way to create something beautiful. It's just so inspiring.
You're going to make me cry.
I know. Well, you make me cry. You really do. You make me cry with joy. And that a huge company has seen the value of what you've created makes me so happy.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's just amazing. And so people need to come out tonight.
I'm going to be there.
I will be there with bells on.
Come out tonight. Yeah. You just need to go and you can email. If you go to our website, there's a way to, you can just email us and let us know you're coming. It's going to be a beautiful night of celebration.
It's Rethreaded's big announcement tonight as this Jacksonville nonprofit partners with Southwest Airlines. Come on out to their warehouse tonight on Barnett Street, just west of I-95, mm-hmm. for the big announcement. And you can shop their store, buy some holiday gifts. You'll love it.
Yeah, change lives.
Kristen Keene, you're just an amazing person, and I'm so proud to know you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And go to Kristen's website, rethreaded.com, for more information about tonight's big bash. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed any part of today's program, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. 1A's up next. The tobacco industry is speaking the truth about cigarettes 11 years after a federal court forced them to. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.